I am Plant on the Line in Vancouver at thecommentary.ca. Described by Margaret Atwood as a writer of great talent and sensitivity, Leslie Hall-Pinder joins me now to talk about her latest novel, her third, Bring Me One of Everything. The novel takes Native history in this part of the world and Ms. Pinder's experience in law, and she weaves a story that's described as an eloquent tale of suspense and intrigue. We'll get Ms. Pinder to tell us about the book, who the characters are, and what drew her to write this book. An anthropologist, Austin Hart, who salvages the artistic remains of the Haida people in British Columbia, kills himself. Years later, another character, Alicia Purcell, is commissioned to write the libretto for an opera based on Hart's life. She's got her own issues, and those are borne out in the book, including her relationship with her mother, Sophie. Leslie Hall-Pinder is a retired attorney who practiced in her own firm, pursuing land claims on behalf of Native clients. She previously wrote two novels, Under the House and On Double Tracks, which was nominated for a Governor General's Literary Award in 1990. The websites for more are at lesliehallpinder.com and bringmeoneofeverything.com. The book is published by Grace Swan Press. Please welcome to the Plant on the Line program, Leslie Hall-Pinder. Ms. Pinder, good morning.
Good morning, Joseph.
Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
So I read in the bio that you live in Vancouver and also on an island on the coast. You're on the island right now?
I am. I'm on beautiful Hardy Island, and I've just launched my boat with great trepidation, and here I am, ready for the interview.
Yeah, so for people who don't know where Hardy is, that's on this side of the coast, I guess, right?
Yeah, it's just off the Sunshine Coast, fairly near Powell River, but it's an off-the-grid island, and so I turned the solar panel in order to get electricity to run my computer in order to write more books.
Yeah, and you can get internet or no?
Yes, the internet is actually, there's a wonderful fellow here who climbed 300 feet up a tree and positioned the receiver so it could get a signal from Nelson Island. So, you know, I look up the tree and I'm grateful for even being able to talk to you.
Yeah. I just started the book, one of the reasons why I don't finish the books before I talk to the authors is because I have the terrible habit of giving away the ending. And
yes.
And I understand there's a twist in the book or one of the reasons Alicia pursues this opera. Well, I don't want to give it away now, but let's begin with Austin Hart. He's an anthropologist, and what does he do on the Queen Charlotte Islands? I guess what was that 50 years ago?
Yes, in the late 50s, he was commissioned in the novel to go and check out Haida Gwaii, and particularly an island called Minstons, in order to see whether or not what was thought to be the last and largest remaining stand of totems in the world, whether or not, in fact, the totems were still standing, because the island hadn't been lived on for, it was thought, about 100 years. So he, in the book, he goes up there and he stays with the people, and eventually he goes out and assesses the polls and brings an expedition the next year, and they take the polls, as it was said then, for salvaging, and put them in a museum so that they could be preserved. So that is actually the initiating event for the entire book, and that much is based on a true historical event, but from then on, I kick it off with the creation of Austin Hart and as you've mentioned, Alicia Purcell, who is my protagonist, who eventually is charged with writing a libretto about his life, but it becomes a real quest to find out why this man at the height of his career with international acclaim, why 7 years after he took the polls, he committed suicide in his office at UBC, and that becomes her almost obsessive, I suppose, search in the novel for why he did it, and the novel also reveals why she wants to do this, what is driving her. she doesn't really know in the beginning, but it gradually unfolds as to what is in it for her as she kind of unpacks her own psychological dilemmas and obstacles in this search.
Now, Austin Hart, he's your character. You created him, but is he based on this guy Wilson Duff?
Well, he is to the extent that Wilson Duff was an anthropologist at the university who did lead this expedition to do exactly what my character ultimately does, and for Wilson Duff, it was 20 years after the expedition that he took his own life, and it became a. I learned about the story many years ago, and many people in the area know about him, know about the historical facts. But I, so I used this event and as I said, used it to kick off the events in the novel.
So in real life, I guess Duff went to the same place that Hart went to. Is that correct?
Yes, he did.
Yeah. You mentioned that they go there to salvage the totem poles. That the island was uninhabited. Why was that?
Well, it's hard to know. I mean, obviously, smallpox was probably a very big factor, because the Haida and the coastal peoples were pretty much decimated as a result of the smallpox. Their numbers went from in the thousands to being in the hundreds, and of course the people had to regroup, and it was Austin Hart actually it really dawns on him eventually what this devastation was for the people, that it wasn't only the incursion of missionaries and settlers that completely changed their way of life, but it was this their whole, all their peoples were dying all around them, and that's no doubt a major reason why this island. And it was very, very remote. In instances, it's hard to get to. It was hard to get to for Wilson Duff, and it was hard to get to for my character. So the people kind of regrouped, and they were in fact moved by Indian Affairs from many, many villages into one major center. So I've lost track of your question, but yeah. I think that's why a major reason why the island wasn't inhabited, but as was discovered, these poles were in wonderful shape. I mean, many of them had been ravaged, but there were beautiful poles that you can now see. If you go to the Museum of Anthropology at UBC or right. Out at the museum in Victoria. Yeah.
Now, Alicia Purcell, Alex, she's the protagonist, as you said, in the book. What's she like?
Well, in the beginning, she's she's running her own publishing company. She's a well-published poet, but she's pretty closed down. She's... her relationship with her mother, whom she detests, Sophia, has really wrecked her. And although she's, pretty successful on the surface, she's got a lot of blocks and feels unloved and all that stuff. So she's pretty retracted in the beginning of the book, and it's through their search for why Austin Hart killed himself, which is also what. She's had, as she describes it, a bout with suicide when she was young, and that's the superficial, perhaps not superficial, but that's a big draw for her to understand. She wasn't able to do it. I mean, her own suicide was actually interrupted by her mother calling, her horrible mother calling, and finally she picked up the phone, and this intention was interrupted, and she's fascinated by this man, why he would, at the height of his game, why he would do this, and he was successful. So she's got a kind of morose curiosity, which turns into something that really, through her searching, ultimately saves her own life as she kind of unpacks her the psychological blocks and in her life and becomes closer to her mother, who in the opening of the book is ill. And so it's something that becomes really a journey for both Sophia, her mother, and herself, that brings them closer, despite, you know, Alex really being very wary and very suspicious of her mother. It turns out to be something that they both need to do.
Oh, on the cover of the book are two masks, and my
right.
understanding is that they play a part in the book. One's got, I guess, one's sighted and one's not sighted, right?
Yes, these are actual stone masks which were collected, as they say, by an ethnographer around the turn of the century. They're Tsimshian masks, although some people thought that they were Haida masks. They moved around a bit, and they are twin masks, and it was eventually figured out that they were worn in these, what we would describe as very mystical dances, where one was worn by the dancer on the inside, the unsighted mask, which when you look at it, there's no opening for the eyes, mm-hmm. and they're made of stone, so the eyes are completely covered, and the sighted mask, which has perforations for the eyes, that was worn by the dancer on the outside. So it's very counterintuitive why you would have the sighted mask on the outside of a mask that was in fact unsighted, if you can understand. But what was learned was that the dancer would dance these masks in the longhouse in these ceremonial dances, and the mystery was how a stone mask could see, and it becomes a very, very large, really wonderful and mysterious metaphor for blindness and sight, for death and life, for all the polarities which really are brought together as Alicia learns in the blink of an eye, so that the sighted and unsighted metaphor becomes like the opening and closing of an eye. And it becomes also a big symbol for the relationship between Sophia and her mother, Sophia becoming unsighted in the end of the book, and her daughter becoming the one that has to lead the way. So it sounds a little esoteric, but I think it unpacks well in the book. But it is the guiding metaphor, these stone masks, which fascinated the anthropologist Austin Hart and comes to fascinate Sophia, trying to understand how they were used and what they were about and what they were for.
Do you think that in picking up this book, that one can learn about the Native experience, about Native art, say?
Well, there's a lot of richness in that way in the book, because what Alicia does in trying to understand Hart's suicide, Hart's, you know, why he took the poles, what he understood about the poles, and then his ultimate death, she kind of retraces his steps. She is helped by another character named Miles George, who is a Native man who's like a shaman, and he guides her. He gives her advice. He tells her, you know, you must, for example, experience what the Native spirit dance is like. And so she goes with him to one of these dances, which is still a very rich and important part of Coast Salish tradition now. But they're private events, and she goes into these dances and is terrified by what she sees, because it's unlike anything she's ever known. So you do learn through what Alex puts herself through. You learn as a reader a great deal about many of the customs and traditions of the Coast Salish people through what she goes through and how she struggles with trying to understand the meaning of these dances and the meaning of spirit. And as Miles George says to her, you know, the spiritual world and the material world, they are not there is not such a divide between them, and she has to understand that in order to understand the poles, the masks, and really, you know, what her own spiritual life is about. So it's rich in that way, but it's not merely an ethnographer's journey. It's really the journey of her as a personality, as a character, trying to understand her own relationship to the world and her mother.
Yeah. Now, the title "Bring Me One of Everything" that comes from. Does someone in the book say that, or is that something that was said, I guess, in the past when anthropologists, you know, explored this part of the world or went to these parts of the world to get stuff?
Yeah, it is. It's a quote that there was in the 1880s, the Smithsonian sent out ethnographers, as they were called then, early anthropologists, into native villages, especially in northern BC, and they were sent out because it was thought at that time that the native peoples were not going to survive. And it was, you know, I suppose a good guess that they wouldn't. And the title has a kind of ironic twist to it, because although it sounds like a statement of abundance and largesse, really it was a statement by one of these ethnographers in a northern native village, kind of the story that I was told, was that this man came into the village, he sat in the middle of the village, and he said to the chiefs and the headmen, "Bring me one of everything," that he wanted to collect one of everything that they had in order to take it back to the Smithsonian and put it in a museum, because they needed to collect these things because there wouldn't be any more. And so it has a terrible kind of twist to it, but it becomes, in the novel, as the novel progresses, it becomes more a statement of particularly what the characters learn is that they have one of everything, that it becomes a consciousness of the abundance that they have, that they don't need to hoard things, which is also another big theme in the novel, that, you know, that it's the theme of hoarding and collecting and keeping on every level, keeping artifacts, keeping memories, keeping lost loves, in a way that really means that they atrophy, and there's a kind of greed that propels a lot of the anthropology at the time, and probably in some sense still does, although the world of anthropology has changed, but it becomes more a, we have one of everything. You don't need to keep things so tight. You can share the wealth. And that's something that Alicia learns, particularly about the Haida people, that their belief about wealth was that the person who was wealthy, a measure of their wealth was what they gave away. And that was the measure of their richness, which is certainly contrary to the way our society is normally run, but it's a big lesson that probably is good for all of us to learn, that you get more when you give away things.
Yeah, indeed, yeah. Growing up, did you always write?
Well, I figured from a pretty early age that I used to hide myself away in what was a cedar closet, a room in the basement of the house where all the off-season clothes were put, and I would hide there, and I would write poetry and journals, and that's really was my first taste of the excitement of what it means to be able to use language to express an inner world. And so I got the bug early on, and was encouraged to write, and then was a little sidetracked by becoming a lawyer, although it provided me with so much, because the work I did was for Native people and the land claims, so I was terrifically enriched by it. But I tried to keep up both professions, and finally, you know, and I published two books while I was practicing law, but eventually the legal work was too demanding, and I did that for many years, and then finally got back to writing. So I've been writing full-time for about 7 years and have managed to finish this book, and I've got another one that's pretty much completed, and so that's my job now, to be a writer.
Yeah, and you find you can write when you're in town here in Vancouver or when you're up there in Hardy?
Well, it's easier up here. I mean, it's so mm-hmm. quiet, you know. It's very still, and the seals and the eagles sometimes distract me, but it's so beautiful. So I do a lot of my writing on this island, and you know, do redrafting and such when I'm in more urban centers and such.
Yeah. So you write on a computer, right?
I do.
Yeah. Do you ever write longhand, say shorthand?
Well, I take notes. You know, I'm like most writers, who've got piles and piles of notebooks, but I actually do the work on the computer and redraft on the computer, although the first two novels were all written longhand, and you know, revising was a very, very arduous. It's much easier now, of course, but I use a computer.
I read somewhere that the first novel, Under the House, that came out well over 20 years ago, I guess, right?
Yes.
Yeah, it was reissued this year. You'd made some revisions to it, is that correct?
Yes, it was out of print, and a new publisher, read the book and wanted to reissue it, and I was happy with that, and then she said, well, why, you know, maybe you should think of doing some revisions to it. And I was a bit shocked at the idea, and yeah. I thought, well, you know, I mean, I think most people say, well, why, you know, you can revise nonfiction, but why would you possibly revise fiction? I mean, but I looked at the book and reread it, and I thought, you know, the image that I finally settled on was it's like a photograph that you take with old equipment, and it's not quite crisp enough. And I was just going to revise the first chapter. I didn't change the story at all, but there's some just perception, some imprecision in language, and I started playing with it. And so that's the revisions that I did to the book, and I'm happy that I did. You know, it's true to the book, but there's just some clarification which I've worked on, because I'm, you know, I think my writing has improved hopefully over the years, and so I thought, well, why reissue a book if I can make it a little bit more enjoyable for a reader and for me as a writer? So that's the heresy that I committed. Of course, I've looked back to see other writers. There's many writers who have revised their fiction, so it's not an atrocity, but it is a bit unusual, I suppose.
Yeah, no, I've read somewhere that this is considered your finest work. You're proud of this book, are you?
Bring me one of everything?
Yeah.
I really am proud of it. It took a long time to write, and it took a long time for me to really find what Alicia's story was about, but I'm very proud of it, and I think it's a read that works on a lot of different levels. I think you can read it as a kind of mystery story and you know, move through it fairly quickly, or you can take your time, and it works on a whole bunch of different levels, I hope, and that was my intention. So I'm, you know, what you want to do as a writer is you want to write something and then be finished with it, so you don't have to write it again. And
right.
I feel like I've done that with this book. I feel like I've completed these things I wanted to say about these themes, and I don't have to do it again.
Yeah, you've made me want to read the book, and I'm sure people listening to us will do the same. Thanks for your time today, Leslie.
Oh, it's been a pleasure, Joseph. Thank you.
You're very welcome. The websites for more, LeslieHallPinder.com, BringMeOneOfEverything.com. The book is called Bring Me One of Everything. It's published by Gray Swan Press. Its author, Leslie Hall Pinder, on the line from Hardy Island in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Planta.